Since April of 1997, the Buffalo Field Campaign has been standing in defense of the harassment and slaughter of our country's last wild buffalo, the Yellowstone herds. This week on The Compass, KPTZ reporter Chris Bricker talks with the campaign's co-founder and coordinator, Mike Meese, who came through Port Townsend with the Buffalo Field Campaign Roadshow to raise awareness of the natural habitat of these wild, free-roaming buffalo and other native wildlife. Joining him is Patrick Johnson, Montana native and co-chair of the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship's Green Sanctuary Environmental Action Committee. And now, let's go into the compass. Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working both in the field and in the policy arena to stop the harassment and slaughter of America's last wild buffalo, and stands with First Nations to honor the sacredness of the wild buffalo as well. With us today is the campaign's co-founder and coordinator, Mike Meese. Also joining us is Patrick Johnson, co-chair of the Green Sanctuary Environmental Action Committee at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Born and grew up in a small town near the Canadian border in north central Montana, within sight of the Rocky Mountain Front and Glacier Park, and having spent several years in Montana in local and larger political arenas, he brings that perspective to our discussion today, along with Mike Meese. Well, welcome both of you. Welcome, Mike Meese. Welcome to Port Townsend and KPTZ.
Thanks for having us.
Michael, you've been visiting communities in Washington, Oregon, California since 1999 to share music and stories and video and discussion about the last wild bison. How did all this come about? And how did you originally become involved with co-founding this project?
Two big questions. The last one I'll take first. How did I start this? I was involved in 1990 in helping found a group called Cold Mountain, Cold Rivers, and we did environmental and human rights documentaries all around the world, based out of Missoula, Montana. And as I helped and created like over 20 different nonprofit documentaries for groups and did a number of other things, that kind of led my trail to an issue in a place I called home, Montana. And starting to go down there for about 3 years before we started this organization, and just documented it, got to go into the capture facilities, went inside a slaughterhouse, and then created a little video that was called Our Buffalo, Our Choice, and sent that around. And at the time, Rosalie Little Thunder, a traditional Lakota elder, worked for a nonprofit group over in Rapid City called the Intertribal Bison Cooperative. And they represented 60 tribes that wanted to reintroduce live Yellowstone buffalo back to their reservations. And so she was blown away with what was going on, made 60 copies, sent it out. Then a prayer was gathered at the capture facility in 96, 97. And that's when we met in person. And we decided that no other nonprofits were living in the area, witnessing what was going on, being able to show the world. And so we felt it was important that somebody, at least first and foremost, monitored, documented, and held these agencies liable for what they do with all Americans' taxpayer dollars.
And Patrick, you grew up, and I think you saw your first buffalo when you were just a little tyke, right?
That's right. I was thinking about that earlier today, and not a live buffalo, but my uncle, Grant, who was a hunter, actually had a buffalo head on his wall in his living room in the little town that I grew up in. And so that was my introduction. And then when I was, again, just a kid, I remember seeing a buffalo, and I was just stunned. I was just kind of blown away by that. And then the old timers in the little town that I grew up in would talk. The buffalo were all gone, of course, by the time that they homesteaded it. But they would talk about the bison that roamed in that area. I grew up on the prairie, and so it's vast. And I could just imagine the bison filling the place and covering it. It's a pretty amazing thing. And so I became curious about the buffalo, and then became aware of the campaign that Mike's the co-founder of and have been following it all of these years.
And Mike Meese, that brings us to the whole idea of the capture facilities and actually the fact that the original buffalo was decimated to the point of, what, about 20 or 30?
I believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the ironic twist of all this is they discovered they were down to so few. First, they sent out the U.S. Cavalry to stand guard for about a year and a half until they were able to establish the national park system. And, of course, Yellowstone was our first one, and it was supposed to be a safe zone to give them some habitat to let them exist. And now here we are, what, 130, 140 years later, and now you have the National Park Service heavily involved. And I mean, this capture facility is located a mile and a half inside Yellowstone National Park. So a lot of these animals are never even leaving the park before they're rounded up and shipped to slaughter. But the real problem is how the Park Service was forced into this. Back in 1996-97, there was a very admirable superintendent known as Mike Finley, and he really stood up for the park, and he was like, well, Montana, if you have a problem with the bison, then you deal with it. You come up with your own management plan, and through court-ordered mediation, they developed this plan they're currently operating under, the Interagency Bison Management Plan. And it's all done through the eyes, basically, of the cattle industry. They call for a population cap of the Yellowstone herd at never exceeding 3,000. Well, carrying capacities that have been done in the park, solely in the park, just talking about that habitat, call for a minimum of 6,000 to 10,000. And then, of course, we live in a very luxurious place in the world. Yellowstone is surrounded by three states, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And we're blessed with tons of national forests, public lands, and most of the parks are surrounded by these as buffer zones, breathing valves, so that the animals can migrate out of the high elevation, high snows of winter. But currently, that habitat is only open to the elk, who ironically also have disease, have supposedly transmitted it, where the bison have never done that. And I think the hidden agenda behind all of this is grass in which animals get to eat it. And, you know, I can't say individual ranchers because I know an awful lot of them, and they're good people that don't believe that this is the hype that they're being forced to take it as. And their dictatorship comes from the livestock department, which is in Helena, and the state vet, which also works for the Department of Livestock. And so even though they don't feel, and there's ranchers that have cows within these zones that really are not that worried, and they know that it's never been a problem. But, you know, right now, no pun intended, Montana is receiving a cash cow from the federal government to manage, slaughter these animals and do all the dirty work at all of our expense. And we're not trying to say that we want to eliminate the cattle way of life, but we think that there's easy ways for this to coexist. And I think a lot of percentage of people that live in Montana love it for its uniqueness, its wildness. You know, all of us could go move into cities or move to suburbia, but we chose Montana because it's still wild. And part of that wild are these wild bison, and that's why we're trying to work to get them to be able to be a wildlife species and wander our lands once again.
Patrick, you've been familiar with the whole cattle lobby and how this all sifts out from a power point of view. What's been your experience?
Well, they're very powerful, and it's very difficult in Montana, as Mike is suggesting, to oppose them. governors have been brought to their knees by the livestock industry, and they, at least in my view, are not always representative, as Mike suggested, of individual ranchers. I think traditionally they have had a lot of power and they're reluctant to let go of it. And then they also are resistant to the science. The science is clear on the brucellosis that Mike talked about. And there is, I want to emphasize this again, there has never been a single documented case of the transmission of brucellosis from a buffalo to a cow. It simply hasn't happened. So a lot of the livestock industry's opposition is based on myth. And I think that the livestock folks are, a lot of them are really, really good people. They try to do the right thing. But I think that they're putting forth a falsehood that a lot of folks have bought into. And it puts the state of Montana in a really tough position. And the politicians have bought into that as well. And so, hence, the livestock department is working very closely with some of the organizations that Mike mentioned and taking the lead in slaughtering buffalo who don't know where boundaries are. There's a buffalo has no clue at all that there's the state of Montana, the state of Wyoming, and the state of Idaho.
They're just land to migrate.
Yeah. They just know that there's forage and food, and that's where I'm going
to
go.
Well, it sounds to me, Mike Meese, that a lot of this is happening from a political point of view, sort of beyond the opinions of the cattlemen on the ground, the people that are looking towards treating buffalo in a way that allows them to propagate in the right kind of way.
Well, there's another perfect pendulum to this circle of craziness is there's also Native Americans involved. Mm-hmm. And that is, to date, 7 different tribes have implemented their treaty rights to be able to go there and hunt buffalo and other wildlife in the Yellowstone ecosystem. And of course, they are starting to receive a lot of the black eye because the way the hunting areas are set up, they're like little mile corridors that they're allowed to hunt on. And then there's private land, then there's another little corridor. And so a lot of buffalo are getting shot in front of the locals. And of course, the tribes really have to implement this to gain recognition as sovereign nations with the U.S. federal government and the state of Montana, which happens with this recognition. But we're coming into a time now where they've been hunting for 8 years. And we just hired, I'm honored to say, on September 1st, our first ever Native American executive director, who is also a Nez Perce brother that did the research and got the treaties recognized for these hunting rights. And so we're going to work more in the realms, especially under this administration, uniting the treaty tribes to kind of turn around and say, look, this management plan is a violation of our treaty rights. And what we were talking about before, the ironic twist of all this, but, you know, the buffalo can't come out of the park. When they come out, they're either hunted, hazed back, or captured and sent to slaughter before they even leave. But the management plan now, with working with APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, have removed a lot of the penalties that occur to the cattle industry when a transmission takes place. And they've made this buffer zone to the western end of Yellowstone all the way out to the Gravelly Mountains, which is about 100 miles, physical miles of habitat that's opened in what they call the designated brucellosis surveillance area. And so the elk are allowed to go there. To the northern range, they go all the way up to the Crazy Mountains, which is another 100-mile corridor that's been open. And the tribes can only hunt on what is called unclaimed lands. And so the park is claimed federal land, but our national forest, our public lands, our state parks, that kind of stuff is referred to as unclaimed lands. So by only allowing the elk out in this habitat, who have been documented 3 times a year almost in the last 5 years of transmitting the disease to the cows, are all allowed to wander out there and the bison aren't. So we feel this might have potential to be a really good lawsuit that they're not allowing these buffalo to be wild animals and come out to lands where they're able to hunt them. And So a lot of those arenas we work in, as well as being on the front lines, documenting everything that happens.
I want to add that the reason that Mike and the others from the Buffalo Field Campaign are making their way through California, Oregon, Washington, and other places, because we're talking about a national treasure here. I can't remember if the bison has been designated as a national mammal or not. It has. And so think about this analogy to the folks here in the Pacific Northwest, that the bison or the buffalo are as to the Plain Indians as the salmon are to the Northwest Indians. Sacred, spiritual. Of course, historically, they've been an important source of food and a host of other things that tribes needed to make their way through life. And so by creating an awareness all over the country and indeed the world, hopefully the folks will join in and create political pressure to change the policies of the government.
This might be a good opportunity right now to honor the buffalo. Bison, buffalo, interchangeable, yes?
Yeah, the buffalo is the common used term for talking about them, but the official scientific is actually bison, bison, bison. But both are acceptable and both are used.
I had the honor of being part of a small group that was able to go out and observe the herd that the Piikani Nation were in charge of the herd itself. And there were probably about 300 head. And I remember seeing them going up a draw with this beautiful, beautiful tan and brown blanket of hooves and fur and just heading out up the draw in this big blanket. And it was the most beautiful, awesome sight that I've ever seen. I was talking to one of the tribal elders that was along with us. You know, he was talking about the whole idea of the behaviors of the buffalo and what the leaders of the herd do and how they look after their charges. And I just thought that that was quite fascinating and very moving. And I'm really happy that I was able to see that.
To see a buffalo in the wild is an extraordinary thing. As you suggested, Chris, it's absolutely breathtaking. And how they care for their young, how they care for one another within the herd and pay attention is incredible. One of the real special treats is to go to Yellowstone in the wintertime, in part because there aren't very many people there, but the bison are foraging for food. And these are tough animals that over the years have evolved with these massive heads so that they can push snow away to find the grass. And it's just absolutely breathtaking. And I hope that everyone gets a chance to see the bison in the wild, and it'll fortify the desire of many of us to protect them.
Mike Meese, can you speak to the preservation efforts? This was part of it, what I saw, protecting the original bison that existed on the plain.
I'd just like to add first a little bit to your previous conversation. I mean, having the honor of spent the last 23 years with these beautiful animals, I've learned a lot. I mean, they have gifts that they could teach humanity how to survive a little bit better. They have leaders, as we both talked about, but their leaders are tasked with taking care of everyone in the herd. Because in the buffalo world, everyone is equal. They all matter just as much. And they share the burdens. You talked about winter. They share the burdens of survival. And when they're walking through these deep winter snows that can be 6-8 feet tall, they walk in a straight line. And the lead buffalo will pound and work the hardest. But when he or she gets tired, they step to the side. The entire procession goes by. And then they jump in at the very end. And so they share the burden of survival together. And of course, being a keystone species and of that size, they help the whole entire community of animals survive, because you'll see the elk use those trails, the deer use, you know, because once a path is made in the winter, it's a big thing for them to have mobility and be able to move. So to me, they've taught that gift that we need to look at each other as all equal. And we need to work towards things that are a benefit for all of us instead of just a few.
That was a salient conversation that took place on our way back from seeing that herd.
I can imagine.
Yeah. The keystone species. The whole idea of a keystone species. And for those that are listening that may not be familiar, we want to describe what a keystone species is.
Basically, it's a species that is cornerstone to the ecosystem, that it ensures its survival. In different animals can play that role. There was a study done in tide pools that kind of determined that the keystone species was a starfish because it made sure it kept all the other predators from eating everything else in there. And on the plains, the buffalo are known as the species that takes care of everything, you know. A gift that we don't often talk about because so many of these poor animals are now confined behind fences, etc. They are the restorers of the land. That's their biggest gift they have. Every year, we'll see the same herd migrate through the same areas, and they don't stay and eat every blade of grass. They come through, spend a week or two, and then migrate on. And in that process, of course, they eat the grasses, spill the seeds. Their hoofs are cleft, and so as they walk, they till the soil. And of course, you got the magic fertilizer coming out the back end, and you have a perfect regeneration process. And I think in a historical perspective, like, you know, on the edge of the prairies, we used to have the 14-foot tall grasslands. And they were 100% dependent on those bison migrating through annually and eating and spilling the seeds, replanting it. And then they'd come back, and the bison are gone and are beautiful grasslands are gone as well. And just, you know, a species that takes care of more than just itself and an ecosystem, but kind of is a caretaker for all of those involved, I think, is a description.
Being the essential species that should not become extinct. The involvement of the Intertribal Buffalo Council now is pretty important, yes.
Without a doubt. Unfortunately, they're all being kind of pigeonholed once again by the livestock industry that we can only cure or transport them this particular, you know, by through domestication means. Essentially, they take the orphan calves of the killed parents that test negative. The females have to go through a 6-year being living behind 2 birthing cycles to prove that they're still not carrying the disease at all. But the bottom line is the lack of science here. Right now, the only test they have is called the seropositive blood test, which is pretty Neanderthal in the science world, to say the least, but it's only an indicator that they've ever had the disease in their system, has no information about transmittability. That the only effective test that they have nowadays is called the necropsy test, which can only be conducted when they're dead. But the ironic thing of all this, and it's one area where us and the livestock folks really agree, is currently brucellosis abortus is listed on the bioterrorism watch list of our country. So the only people that can do any research are top-level secret scientists because it's listed as a bioterrorism agent, when brucellosis abortus has no potential whatsoever to be one. And so we've tried to write letters, tried to get some pressure applied to, because, I mean, the wildlife do not seem to be affected by it. They're populating, they're regular, and they don't have the abortion that it causes for domestic animals. And so I would think, not being a scientist, but logically, that potentially they have a cure in these animals they're killing of the disease itself. And then we could simplistically vaccinate the cattle because we round them up every year. We vaccinate them for numerous other things, and they are essentially the one controllable element in this equation. And so that would be my suggestion, that we just remove this disease paranoia and work on a solution for that, and then move on.
The campaign has been involved in its activism since 1997. Over the years, what are some of the salient things that have happened as a result of your activism?
One thing is kind of this weird parody. When we first started, we were able to document what happened to these poor young calves in the spring, getting captured, getting pregnant moms. And so that looked so horrible on video that they implemented a new tactic that they thought was a good thing, and it's called hazing. And hazing, by definition, is moving something from where it wants to be to where you want it to be in a very forceful fashion. And this, of course, included helicopters, ATVs, 4x4s, horses, anything basically but their feet. And they would run these animals, and we're talking about 1-day-old to 2-week-old calves, moms either just that had given birth or bursting at the seams ready to. And of course, these are all the animals that just survived an intense Yellowstone winter. And they were being run up to 15 miles back into the park, you know, with helicopters and all this. And so 5 years ago, we documented in the middle of one of these hazing operations, a grizzly bear getting caught up in it. And not because they care about bison, but because grizzly bears, for the moment, are listed as an endangered species. We were able to get the feds to pull their money out of the plan. And of course, the state of Montana has not been able to come up with the funds to do it. So for the last 5 years, there have not been helicopters. Last year, you might have heard of our current governor. He was one of the 857 Democratic presidential nominees, Governor Steve Bullock. Mm-hmm. But he did some monumental things, and in talking about earlier how it really is hard to stand up as a politician to the government, especially our state legislation. Mm-hmm. The governor went ahead and made at least the north side of the Madison River and all the national forest year-round habitat for the bison, and that's where the central herd migrates to have their babies. But of course, in the nativity, they only did the north side, even though the south side has tons of national forest and public lands. But now hazing operations consist of running them down a few miles down the road and then making them swim across the river and pushing them to Horse Butte. And then November of 2014, we finally had our scientific ducks in a row, and we filed for a listing for the Yellowstone herd under the endangered species list under the distinct population clause. And we last year had our first big round in the courts, and we won, and of course they appealed, so we won the appeal. And then right the week before I left on this show, they just canceled the whole thing and said, no, it doesn't work. And so we have at least 2 more years to go in the court, but that may be a blessing in disguise, because obviously, as we all know, this current administration is adamantly attacking the endangered species listing, and I think a 2-year break might bring us back to reality in this world.
Well, talking about reality in this world, we're coming to a close here. I want to thank Patrick Johnson and Michael Meese for joining us today at KPTZ. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how people could actually contribute to the campaign, to take action, or to become a volunteer with the campaign.
Well, let's start with the fun part. From mid-November until the end of May, we accept volunteers, and we are actually physically out in the field with the buffalo that are in danger and out of the park. For all that time, we document it. Basically, all you do is you go online, fill out a small application, and then once you come and go, we pay for your food, your lodging, your housing. We're supported by Patagonia, and so we have great outdoor gear, and you'll get you on skis in the winter or snowshoes, and you'll get to go see the buffalo. There's also online buffalofieldcampaign.org is our website. Millions of ways that you can do things in your own local communities. Right now we're on a speaking tour, and annually we will do that. And if anyone wants to try and organize something in their community, if you're interested in just doing it by yourself, we have information packets, videos we can send you, and you can do your own outreach in the communities. Back to what we talked about earlier, these are our national mammal, and I didn't really go into it, but there's 600,000 bison in the United States right now, but all but less than 10,000 of those are beefalo. They're not pure buffalo. And so of these 10,000 that are genetically pure, most of them live behind fences, are hay-fed and domesticated. There's a herd in Henry's Mountains, but they're landlocked and they cannot leave that area. And so the last remnant we have in direct descendants of the 30 to 60 million that used to roam continent North America are the Yellowstone herd. And that's why we fight for their rights. They are the true bison. bison that still migrate as much as they can, that have never depended on humans for any assistance in life. And so that's why we stand our ground, and that's why we feel this is at least an American issue, if not an international issue, you know.
Michael Meese, Patrick Johnson, thank you for joining us today, KPTZ.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Chris Bricker for KPTZ Community Radio News.
This week's Compass was written and produced by Chris Bricker. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, this is Compass Executive Producer Steve Evans.